Lecture 5 of The Foundations of Human Experience. This is the synopsis. The convergence of the three activities of the soul. The connection of cognitive and will activities in the antipathetic and sympathetic processes of seeing. The great isolation of the human being from the environment in contrast to that of animals. The necessity of an interpenetration of thinking and willing. Isolation from the world in seeing and connection with the world in doing. The struggle against animalistic, quote-unquote, sympathetic instincts through the integration of moral ideals. The intertwining of soul activities exemplified by the argument between Brentano and Zygmunt about the nature of human judgment. Feeling as retained cognition and willing. The revelation of hidden sympathy and antipathy in willing and thinking. The rise of feeling in the body through the touching of blood and nerves exemplified by the eyes and ears. The argument between Wagner and Hanslick concerning feeling and cognition in musical hearing. The erroneous position of modern psychology exemplified by sense theory. Errors in Kantianism. The end of the synopsis. Lecture 5 given in Stuttgart, August 26, 1919. Yesterday we spoke about how the will is integrated into the human organism. We now want to use what we have learned about the relationship of will to the human being to obtain a view of the rest of human nature. You will have noticed that until now my discussions of the human being have been mainly concerned with intellectual and cognitive activities on the one hand, and with the activity of the will on the other. I have shown how thinking relates to the human nervous system, and how strength of will relates to the activity of the blood. When you think about what we have already discussed, you may ask yourself what the situation is with the third capacity of the soul, with the activity of feeling. We have not yet taken this into account. However, as we focus today more upon the activity of feeling, we will be able to penetrate the other two sides of human nature, the cognition and the will, more intensely. Nevertheless, we must be clear about one thing that I have also mentioned in various other connections, namely that we cannot pedantically separate the capacities of the soul, thinking, feeling, willing, because in the living soul one activity always involves others. Let us first look at the will. You will surely be aware that you cannot want something that you have not yet penetrated through thinking, that is, through a cognitive activity. Attempt to concentrate, if only superficially, upon your willing. You will find that in the act of willing there is always some kind of thinking. If thinking were omitted from a deed of will, you would not even be human. If you did not integrate the deeds that well forth out of your will with thinking, you would just do every willed deed dumbly and instinctively. In the same way that all willing contains thinking, all thinking contains the will. Even a superficial observation of yourself will reveal that when you think, you always allow the will to flow into the formation of thoughts. A subtle will activity permeates how you form thoughts, how you connect thoughts with one another, and how you proceed to judgment and decision. We can only say that willing is mainly will activity and contains an undercurrent of thinking. Thinking is mainly thought activity and has an undercurrent of will. Thus it is not possible to pedantically segregate individual soul activities for observation, because one flows into the other. What you can recognize as the soul, the intertwining of soul activities, you see expressed in the body that reveals the soul activity. Take the human eye, EYE, for example. When we observe it in its totality, the nerves continue into the eye. However, the same is true of the blood vessels. In that the nerves continue into the eye, thinking and cognitive activity flow into the eye. And where the blood vessels continue into the eye, the activity of the will also flows into it. In this way, will and cognition are connected even to the periphery of the body's sense activities. The cognitive element enters our will and movements through the nerve pathways, and the will element enters through the blood vessels. This is true for all the senses, as well as for all limbs that serve the will. Now we must also learn about the particularities of cognitive activity. I have already mentioned them, but we need to be fully aware of everything that lies in the direction of cognition and thinking throughout the whole complex of human activity. I have already said that antipathy lives in cognition and thinking. As strange as it may seem, antipathy permeates everything that tends toward thinking. You might say, quote, "When I look at something, I am certainly not being antipathetic," unquote. Nevertheless, you are. You exercise antipathy when you look at an object. If there were only nerve activity in your eye, then every object you look at would be repulsive and antipathetic to you. The feeling of antipathy in seeing is quelled in your consciousness, since will activity, sympathy, enters into every activity of the eye because the blood vessels stretch into your physical eye. Through a balance between sympathy and antipathy, an objective act of seeing occurs. It occurs because sympathy and antipathy come into balance, but we are not at all conscious of this interplay. If, as I have already mentioned in this connection, you study Goethe's theory of color, namely the physiological didactic portion, then you will see that since Goethe encompasses the deeper aspect of sight, he can observe sympathy and antipathy in the nuances of color. You need only penetrate the activity of a sense organ a little to immediately see how sympathy and antipathy arise in sensing. Antipathy originates in the cognitive aspect, in the conceptual aspect, in the nerves. Sympathy originates in the will aspect, in the blood. In my general anthroposophical lectures, I have often emphasized the important difference between the eyes of animals and the eyes of human beings. Animals characteristically have more blood activity in the eye than does the human being. In some animals, you will even find organs that serve this activity of the blood, such as the falciform process and the pleated pectin. From that, you can see that animals have more blood activity in the eye than human beings. This is also true for the other sense organs, which means that in their senses, animals develop much more sympathy, instinctive sympathy with their surroundings than human beings do. In reality, human beings, although they are normally not conscious of it, have more antipathy with their surroundings than animals do. People become conscious of this antipathy only when they react with disgust to an intensified impression of their surroundings. When people are disgusted by their perceptions, the disgust is only an intensification of normal sense perception. If you go somewhere that smells bad and the bad smell disgusts you, your feeling of disgust is nothing other than an increase of what occurs in all sensing. Only the disgust that accompanies perception normally remains subconscious. If we human beings had no more antipathy to our surroundings than animals do, then we would not separate ourselves so strongly from our surroundings as we in fact do. Animals have much more sympathy with their surroundings and are more integrated into them, and therefore are more dependent upon climate and season and so forth than human beings. People have a personality because they have more antipathy toward their surroundings. That we can separate ourselves from our surroundings through unconscious antipathy gives us an awareness of our individual personality. Here we have an indication of something important in comprehending the human being. We have seen how thinking and willing, or expressed physically, the activity of the nerves and the blood flow together in cognitive or reflective activity. In the same way, thinking and willing come together in the active will. Whenever we want something, we always develop sympathy with what is wanted. However, it would always remain an instinctive desire if we could not bring into this sympathy the antipathy that provides a separation between the personality and what is wanted. The problem is that the sympathy with what is wanted dominates. And we can create balance only when we bring in antipathy. Nevertheless, sympathy remains unconscious, and only a little of it penetrates what is wanted. For those few things into which we bring real enthusiasm, devotion, and love, and not simply rationality, sympathy dominates so strongly in willing that it rises into our consciousness, saturating our will with sympathy. Otherwise, the will remains as an objective connection with our surroundings. Just as our antipathy to our surroundings can become conscious only in exceptional cases of cognition, our always present sympathy to our surroundings can become conscious only in exceptional cases, in cases of enthusiasm and devotion. Otherwise, we would always do everything instinctively. We would never be able to relate to what the world objectively demands of us, say, in social life. We must penetrate what is wanted with thinking, so that what is wanted integrates us into the human totality and cosmic process. If you consider what normal life would be like if the whole process I have just described were conscious, you can perhaps clearly see what would occur, what confusion would result in the human soul. If this process in the human soul were always conscious in normal life, then we would generally be conscious of the antipathy that accompanies all our deeds. That would be terrible. People would go through the world always feeling themselves to be in an atmosphere of antipathy. The world has been wisely created, such that even though antipathy is necessary as a force in our deeds, we are not conscious of it, and it remains subconsciousness. We are now looking at a curious mystery of human nature, a mystery that every decent person feels, but one of which the teacher should be fully conscious. As children, we act almost exclusively from sympathy. As strange as it may sound, everything that children do, they do out of sympathy toward the deed. When sympathy is born into the world, it is strong love and willing. However, it cannot remain so. We must permeate it with thinking, and in a sense continuously illuminate it with thinking. This occurs comprehensively when we integrate moral ideals into our simple instincts. Now you may be better able to comprehend what antipathy means in this area. If the instinctive impulses that we find in small children were to remain only sympathetic throughout life, we would develop only animalistically under the influence of instincts. We must become antipathetic to these instincts, that is, we must pour antipathy into them. When we pour antipathy into them through our moral ideals, which are antipathetic to instincts, then we put antipathy into childlike sympathy or instincts, into our life between birth and death. Thus, moral development is always something ascetic. Only we must understand this asceticism in the proper sense. We always practice it in combating animalism. From what I have just said, we should learn not only to what high degree willing is willing in the practical activities of human beings, but also to what extent thinking and cognitive activity thoroughly permeate willing. Human feeling stands right in the middle between thinking, cognition, and willing. If you imagine willing and thinking as I have just developed them, then you will see that everything that is sympathy, namely willing, flows to one side from a point in the middle. You will also see that everything that is antipathy or thinking flows to the other side. However, the sympathy of willing interacts with thinking, and the antipathy of thinking interacts with willing. Thus, humans become complete when something developed primarily in one direction also interacts with what develops in the other direction. Feeling lies in the middle between thinking and willing, and so that feeling connects with thinking in one direction and willing in the other. Just as you cannot easily separate thinking and willing within the human soul, you can even less easily separate the aspects of thinking and willing in feeling. The aspects of thinking and willing are very closely interconnected with feeling. Simple self-observation, even if superficial, can convince you of the correctness of what I have just said. What I have already said will lead to your seeing this correctness since normally we raise objective willing to activity by enthusiasm or love. Here you can see clearly how willing required by the external circumstances of life is filled with feeling. If you do something out of enthusiasm or love, you act by allowing the will to be permeated with subjective feeling. When you look more closely, for instance, in Goethe's color theory, you will see how feeling mixes into sensing. When sensing increases to disgust, or on the other hand to the pleasant feeling of inhaling the scent of a flower, you can clearly see how feeling enters into sensing. However, feeling also enters into thinking. At one time there was a remarkable philosophical debate in Heidelberg between the psychologist Franz Brentano and the logician Zygwart. These two men argued about the nature of human judgment. Zygwart thought that when people made a judgment, for instance, quote, human beings should be good, unquote, such a judgment always contained feeling. In other words, feeling made the decision. Brentano thought that judgment and feeling, that is, emotion, were so different that we could not even comprehend judging if feeling played a role. He thought that subjectivity would then enter into judgment, whereas our judgments want objectivity. Such arguments only show that neither psychologists nor logicians have correctly identified the central fact, namely the interaction of soul activities. Recall what must be considered here. On the one hand, we have the capacity of judgment, that of course must decide about something objective. Whether or not people must be good cannot depend upon our subjective feelings, and thus the content of the judgment must be objective. However, we must also consider something quite different when we judge. Things that are objectively correct are, for that very reason, not conscious in our souls. We must first receive them consciously into our souls. But we cannot have any conscious judgment in our souls without interacting with feeling. Thus Brentano and Zygwart could have agreed with each other if they had both said that the objective content of a judgment lies outside feeling. However, for the subjective human soul to be convinced of the correctness of a judgment, feeling must develop. You can see how difficult it is to arrive at any exact concepts with the inexact philosophical methods currently in use. To arrive at exact concepts, you must first develop ourselves. We must first develop ourselves. Today, however, only spiritual science provides the schooling needed to reach exact concepts. Conventional science thinks that it has exact concepts and mocks what anthroposophy gives. Science has no idea that the concepts derived from anthroposophy are more exact than those in normal usage, because they derive from reality and not from simple wordplay. When you follow feeling toward thinking, and in the other direction, toward will, you will realize that feeling stands between cognition and willing in the center of soul activity and radiates its essence in both directions. At the same time, feeling is incomplete cognition and incomplete will. It is restrained cognition and restrained will. Thus feeling is composed of the sympathy and the antipathy that are, as you have seen, hidden in both cognition and willing. Both sympathy and antipathy are present, but hidden in cognition and willing, because they interact in the bodily activities of the nerves and blood. In feeling they are evident. What then are the physical expressions of feeling? Everywhere in the human body you will find that the blood vessels and the nerve paths touch each other in various ways. Everywhere blood vessels and nerve paths touch, real feeling is created. However, in the senses, for example, the nerves and blood are so subtle that we no longer notice the feeling. Subtle feeling permeates our seeing and hearing, but we do not perceive it. The more separate the sense organ is from the remainder of the body, the less we can perceive the feeling. In seeing, we hardly notice the sympathizing and antipathizing, because the eye is embedded in a bony socket that is almost completely separated from the remainder of the body. Also, the nerves and blood vessels going into the eye are extremely fine. The sensation of feeling in the eye is extremely suppressed. In hearing, feeling is much less suppressed. Hearing is much more closely integrated into the overall activity of the body than is seeing. Since the structures of the numerous organs in the ear are quite different from the structures of the organs of the eye, the ear is in many respects a much truer reflection of what occurs in the entire body. Thus, what occurs as sensing in the ear is more strongly accompanied by feeling. Even people who have very acute hearing will have difficulty being clear about what in hearing, particularly artistic hearing, is simply cognition and what is feeling. This touches upon something interesting that plays a direct role in modern artistic productions. You certainly all know the figure Beckmesser in Richard Wagner's Meistersinger. What is Beckmesser really supposed to represent? He represents someone who understands music, but who completely forgets that human feeling interacts with rational hearing. Wagner, who presented his own opinion in the role of Walter, was, on the other hand, one-sidedly convinced that feeling is mainly what lives in music. In contrast to the correct view of the interaction of feeling and cognition in musical hearing, the misunderstandings represented by Walter and Beckmesser were expressed in an historical event. As Wagner's opera became well known, an opponent of his view was found in the person of Eduard Hanslick in Vienna. Hanslick regarded everything expressed from the realm of feeling in Wagner's music as unmusical. Perhaps no more psychologically interesting writings about art exist than Vom musikalischer Schönen, that is, Concerning What is Musically Beautiful, by Eduard Hanslick. The main theme of this book is that those who emphasize feeling in music are not real musicians and have no true sense of music. True musicians are only those who see the objective connecting of tone to tone as the true center of music, the arabesque devoid of feeling, joining only tone upon tone. With wonderful purity, Hanslick insists that the highest in music occurs only in tone pictures, and he mocks everything connected with Wagner's central view, namely the creation of music from feeling. That such an argument between Hanslick and Wagner could even occur in the field of music shows that modern psychological ideas about soul activity were completely unclear. Otherwise, a one-sided tendency like Hanslick's could not arise. However, if we can see through the one-sidedness and focus upon the philosophical strength of Hanslick's discussions, then we might say that this book is quite insightful. Thus you can see that to a greater or lesser extent, the senses cognitively permeate the periphery of the whole human being who now lives as a being of feeling. This will and must make you take notice of a pedagogical insight that has caused great confusion in modern scientific thought. If we had not spoken here in preparation for what shall guide you into a reforming activity, then you would have had to assemble all the present pedagogies, psychologies, and logics, as well as teaching methods, and take from them what you wish to practice in your teaching. You would have had to bring into your teaching what has become common. However, what is common today suffers from a great psychological error. In every psychology, you will find a so-called sensory theory. When people investigate the basis of sense activity, they derive how the eyes, the ears, the nose, and so forth, sense. They then bring all this together in the major abstraction, quote, sensory activity, unquote. This is a great mistake, an enormous error. If you take only the senses known to today's physiologists or psychologists, if you look only at the physical body, you observe that the nature of the sense of vision is something quite different from that of the sense of hearing. The eye and the ear have two very different natures. Then we have the sense of touch, which has barely been researched, not even in an unsatisfactory manner, as is the case with the eye and the ear. However, let us remain with the eye and the ear. Seeing and hearing are so different that to combine these two activities into a, quote, general sensory activity, unquote, results in nebulous theory. If we wanted to be really accurate, we would have to speak only of the activity of the eye, or of the ear, or of the organs of smell, and so forth. In them, we would find such great differences that we would soon lose all desire to create a general sensory physiology in the way done by modern psychologists. We can have insight into the human soul only when we remain in the area I attempted to delineate in my discussions in Truth and Knowledge and in Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, the Philosophy of Freedom. Then we can speak of a unified soul without falling into abstractions. Then we stand on firm ground because we assume that the human being lives into the world and is not the totality of reality. The human being does not have the totality of reality from the beginning. The human being continues to develop, and in this further development, what previously was not reality becomes, through the interaction of thinking and perceiving, true reality. The human being must conquer reality. In this regard, the Kantianism that has eaten into everything has created terrible confusion. What does Kantianism do? From the beginning, it dogmatically states that we are to look at the world surrounding us, but that only the reflection of this world lives in us. Kant derives all his other deductions from this. He is not at all clear about what exists in the perceptible human surroundings. Reality is not in the surroundings, nor in appearance, but first arises through our quote-unquote conquering reality. So the last thing we arrive at is reality. In principle, true reality is what human beings see at the moment they can no longer speak, namely in that moment when they go to the gates of death. Many false assumptions have entered modern culture, and these act most disastrously in education. We must strive to replace false concepts with correct ones. We will then be able to correctly carry out what we must do in teaching. The end of Lecture 5.